Hi, if we're starting, this is the end of the 15th week, and this has been my best week of all of them, and as I've got down here, I'm improving rapidly. I definitely am accepting it now. I think that I could say that sometime this week, I don't know really when it was, but sometime during this week that I have accepted the fact that she is gone. There's a different feeling that you have when you do accept that. Now, I know I've been talking about that for about 3 weeks, the necessity of doing it and the feeling that you're about to do it, but you're not doing it. And I would find for about the past 3 weeks that when I would think that I have accepted it, I would feel that I pretty well have it put together, why then something would happen that would let me know that I haven't put it together, that there would be a breakdown of some kind that would let me know the feelings on the inside of me that I really hadn't accepted it. But this week I do have that definite feeling that I have accepted it, and there is a different feeling there. As I was talking to the kids, they still have not accepted it. They're still going through those feelings and denying it that it's really happened. Talking to Dina, she said, well, she knows she's still denying it. The first part of this week was a very bad part of the week, and she said the last couple of days have been pretty good, good days, but she knows that that's one of her problems. Kim states that she feels that she is better. She's not as nervous as what she was. Since she's come over here, she misses her more, which I think is a good thing. She, over there where she, Doris was not supposed to be there. In other words, when you get up in the morning, why you didn't anticipate seeing her, why she really didn't miss her because it was just a normal life. But over here she has. And so I think that it's good in her. Dan states he's about the same. He thinks there is some improvement, that he's done a little talking about it, and he does feel that there is some improvement. But again, I feel, and I can feel improvement as the days go by. In fact, tonight, my diary is not going to be very long and be rather boring, and next week, why, we might not have any at all if I keep getting better and better as we go along. But the kind of the feelings this past week have been that Friday, I had a feeling that just as I wrote down, it seems like it's been too long. I can't hold out much longer. I need her, and yet I realize I can't have her. I'm free. What a beautiful word, and yet how ugly. How we desire and love our freedom. Freedom from the press, religion, business, sin, and all other things. And I want the freedom from everything except this one thing. And I think that it was with this, that Friday, that I began to have some feelings along this line that finally provoked the acceptance and whatever happens in your mind. I don't know what happens in your mind, but causes you to finally say that it is there. I just got a feeling of, you know, at that time that it just seemed a heavy feeling, not an intense, painful feeling. And there are two different kind of feelings that I've noted. And that is, up until just recently, it was just an intense pain. It was kind of like if somebody take your arm, twist it behind your back, and it's just about ready to break. And just hold it there. It's just a terrible, painful thing. And then every once in a while, there'd be a stab of where they do it, and maybe crack a bone or something, you know, a terrible stab. And then it goes back to normal, but the normal is just an intense pain that you have. And I don't have that any longer. The feeling I have is more of just a heavy feeling that is weighing on me. Maybe like a fog settling down, only it's not made out of fog, it's made out of cement or something. You know, it's kind of a heavy situation, or kind of like swallowing a steel ball that weighs 2 or 3 pounds. It's just not an intense pain, but just kind of a heavy, sluggish pain that you have. Saturday was a pretty good day. Steve Voss and I worked on a roof all day, and I kept busy, and so that was a good day. Sunday, the last several Sundays have been good days. I've enjoyed them. Monday is supposed to be a good day for me. Always has been, but this past Monday I missed her very badly. And at that time I had that feeling, I felt like I'd had enough, that she'd been gone long enough. It's time for her to come back. And in other words, I just had that I'm fed up feeling, you know, that you would get if you'd have gone to Texas to see your mom and then calling every week and saying, I can't come back this week and this week. Why, you kind of get that feeling after a while that's enough. I don't care what's going on. Get home. And that's kind of the feeling that I had. Tuesday, everything just kind of went along fine each day. There's nothing big went along except little things happened to let you know really how much you miss her, how much fun you had. I was hauling off some garbage, brought some garbage in that was taking to the dump early that morning, and part of it fell off the trailer in the middle of the road. You know what fun that would be. So I got out and got it back on the trailer, and while I was doing it, I was thinking that, boy, you know, normally I'd have something to talk about when I went home tonight. But now then, all it is you just pick it up, throw it on the truck, and go on down your road, you know, and there's not much there. It's a feeling, really, that you realized how much that you had to share together, even if it was picking up garbage. Wednesday, I was really drawn to her grave, and you say, drawn to her grave, what do you mean? I don't know what I mean. I just mean that I hadn't been to her grave for about 4 weeks. I really hadn't wanted to go to the grave. And Dan and I went down and ordered the tombstone. But Wednesday, I just needed to go, I guess, to see what would happen. And when I went, I didn't cry until I started to walk away. And then I lost control. But that's a far, far better situation than it's ever been before. That when you go down there, why, it just, you know, literally tear me up. And then on Wednesday, which would have been yesterday, went down to Burger King, and the Range were down there, and I ordered one of those croissant sandwiches, and Seals wanted to know what I was doing, why I was eating, and said, because I'm hungry. And not only that, yesterday was the first time, really, that I ate three meals, because I wanted to eat three meals. There had been one other time when I'd been with people, and they had forced some food on me three times that day, but I certainly didn't want to eat like that. But yesterday I wanted to eat, and then last night when I went home, I got some cake and crackers to finish off before I went to bed. Got up this morning and ate a breakfast and a lunch, and so my appetite obviously is coming back. Thursday, while I've got here, I'm still hungry. I ate breakfast. Becky left a piece of cake in there, and I finished it off this morning. And so things like this let me know that I am really getting better. And as I've then put down to finish it off, that I realize really what my job is to put everything together and get on to a better life. And kind of looking at it, that putting your 32 years together, and including her death, putting these experiences together, and then getting on and making a better life, you know, out of it. I definitely determined that is necessary. I determined that from way, way back in reading the Apostle Paul, whether I live or whether I die, to glorify God. So in this, why, really, the week has gone very well. I've cried very little this week. I really haven't broken down and have any hard cries. There have been two or three times that tears have popped in my eyes, but really of breaking down and having some hard cries, why, I really, really haven't. I always throw in, are there any humorous things? No, I'm just kind of getting back to normal, not doing too many crazy things. Tuesday morning, I think it was, Don came in and said, you know, if you could just get one more thing straight, you'd be perfect. He said, there's one thing. I said, what's that? And he said, you forgot to turn your lights off when you got in. I said, fine. Now, I've got her all put together. That night, somebody came in for class, I forget what it was, and said, hey, said, I just turned your lights off for you out here. So I left them on a couple times that day, but that's not doing too bad. Another thing to see is the change of attitude, of which I'm talking about, and people interested, is the attitude toward remarriage. Again, that is unchanged, except each week I find that I move more in a negative way of that, of really not wanting to get married. And again, there's ambivalence there. As I said before, there's nothing I would like more than to remarry and have a happy life. And there's nothing that I'm afraid of more than to remarry and have a bad life. And so that really is the situation there. And then again, in this week, it's hitting me and thinking about what she said and so forth along that line. She knew me better than I know me. And everything that she's ever said about me, I don't know if she's ever missed anything yet. It's all been just about right. I can even see when she said that, you know, I'd be totally devastated for a while, and then I'd put my life together. That's true. That's what I'm going to do. And one other thing that she was adamant about, she was very certain about, she didn't ask me about it, didn't ask me what I thought about it, but just stated that you will remarry. And so, I don't know whether I prove her wrong or not, but one thing about it is I wouldn't even know where to look for a wife, and if I found one, wouldn't know how to court her, and if I did start courting her, I'd have to bring her home and get my kids permission, and I just decided it's not worth it. Don Gibbons kind of answered the question a couple of days ago. He said, how are you feeling about remarriage? Says, has it changed any? And I said, no. I said, it just gets more all the time. I said, I get more afraid of it all the time, and he said, well, said, that doesn't look like there's any problem. Said, hadn't been too many women hand in resumes anyway. I said, no, I haven't been over to run with it, so we don't have to worry about that. But at any rate, well, you can see that that I am getting better. Now, let's get on with some of the things that we started this last week in talking about some of the situations of in bereavement. As we start talking here, the effects of bereavement that it has on you. It says the first year or so of bereavement is often a time of greater risk of health problems. As many as 50% of bereaved people perceive that their general health is impaired. They use health services more often. There is, for instance, a 240% increase in consultation for depression, insomnia, similar symptoms, including headaches, dizziness, fainting, blurred vision, skin rashes, excessive sweating, indigestion, difficulty in swallowing, vomiting, and palpitations in the chest pains, shortness of breath, frequent infections, and general aches, nervousness, fears of nervous breakdowns, feelings of pain, peculiar thoughts, nightmares, trembling, loss of appetite or excessive appetite, loss of weight, reduced working capacity or fatigue. Now, these are the general things that people have. Not everybody has them all, but this is kind of a general across-the-board statements that people come up with, the things that happen to them during this period of time. In group studies, I've already talked about this, I think, the death rate. Haven't I talked about that in class, how the death rate, well, I won't go into that then, in the way that works. And the interesting thing about that is, again, and tonight I'm going to talk about some differences in men and women, but the differences in men and women, remember that the first really is that the death rate of men goes way up during the first year, and there is no change in women during the first year. The second year, there is a drastic change in women. That's when their death rate goes way up, and then comes back down, and they level off. So a woman's scale of feeling this way would kind of go like this from the beginning over here to the first year, would just go straight. Then it goes way up, then it comes back down, and then it levels off again. a man's goes from here, goes right up here, and then it levels off and comes down over here like this. And so it is over about a four-year span of time that you look at there. But there's where the women have their problems and men have them in other ways. And of course, the reason is the difference of the way people, the men and women, look at the loss that they've had. Now, here's another table of grief reactions that they found. Many, many things that they have: migraines and headaches and dizziness and fainting spells and blurred vision and facial pains, skin rashes, excessive swellings, indigestion, difficulty in swallowing, ulcers, vomiting, excessive appetite, anorexia, weight gain, weight loss, palpitations, chest pains, asthma, frequent infections, general aching, and diabetes. In this, really with me, the ones that I could say that I have experienced would be the skin rashes. Now, I have some skin rashes that's broken out on me. I've never had any skin problems before, but I've got some pretty good ones now. And by pretty good ones, well, I mean some big blotches that... I don't know if you can see it right there or not, but in other words, some pretty good ones. And I went to the doctor and talked to him about it, and he said, well, said one of the things, you know, your immune system shuts down, and that's another thing that it does. Your immune system just closes off. The way he puts it, he said for about 6 months that it just shuts down. He said, we don't know why, but that's about the way that it does. And then in this, weight loss, chest pains, I've had several of them. I guess that's about all that I see in that particular situation. Another thing that I think is rather interesting is that it has been shown that if a person doesn't grieve heavily and go ahead and grieve and try to get the grieving out of the system, you hold it in, that you're much more susceptible to colds and flus and such things as that. That the percentage of it being up there is way up there. And that's one thing that's happened to Dan ever since Mom died, is that he's been having these colds and flus and so forth much more than the rest of us, which would go to confirm what really has been said. This right here is a chart. The reason I want to get that light on, I will show you this chart. And I've taken this out of a study right here of where of a book to show you what they talk about is actually taking place right here. I realize that you can't read that, you can't see it there, but as you can see, what they have right here is an arrow, and that is that you start out here with your loss, and then you go through a protest period. That's what that says there, of where you're protesting. Now then, what are you protesting about? Well, during this period of time, that's just the word that they use, the things that go on are crying, pain, weakness, nausea, loss of appetite, sleep disturbances, and other physical changes during a period of time here. Then you go on around and you go through a period of despair. During this time, they say you have continuing physical symptoms, slowed thinking and action, an urge to recover that which was lost, that you just you want to try to recover that if you possibly can. That statement is a rather interesting statement. I don't know how to explain it. There's never been a minute where I thought I could recover her. So it's not of that nature of where you think, well, if I do a certain thing, I can bring her back. It's not that. But there is a strong desire, an urge that you have, that you would like to do it if it were possible. Now, I think that a lot of people from my reading go ahead and they don't put that "if it were possible" on there. In other words, they want to bring the loved one back, and they want to do it whether it's possible or not. In other words, they get the feeling, if I do certain things, I might be able to bring them back. See, if I just cry enough, if I will just do a certain thing somehow or another, why, I might be able to bring them back. And that is a something that the interviews talk about a great deal. I've not seen it in my life as being a major problem. I have had the feeling, but it's not a real major problem with me, but it evidently is with a lot of people. Then you go up here through detachment, where you have this detachment period, where you're detaching yourself. Now, what happens here is, they say that you have absent spontaneity, whatever that means, bland expression, no new friendships, and decreased socialization. This is where you are detaching yourself really from everything, actually. And of course, you've heard me say that, you know, I felt that there wasn't any need of living, no, nothing to live for, and so forth. And there is a detachment that you have to the world and to everybody in life itself. Now, again, another thing is inside here, what it tells you then, some other things that you go through. In this first period up here, certain things happen. It's shock, confusion, denial, anger itself, and a lowered self-esteem. Some of these things, like shock, I definitely had. Confusion, you're not able to measure yourself. I don't know whether I was confused or not. There was a I know I was confused some, but to what extent, I don't know. Because I was able to do what I needed to do to make preparation for the funeral and all of these things. But that shock is something where you don't really know the confusion that you're in. So I really can't talk about that. Denial, you do deny it, not consciously. This is another thing. At any moment of any day, you could tell people, yes, she's dead. But it's an unconscious denial that you have. Maybe it won't be that way. It's like me driving home. I go out, I get in the car, and I want to drive home, and wouldn't it be nice if she's there? And I know she's not there, you know, and I tell myself, she's not there. It would, you know, well, she's not there. And you go through a confusion of that nature. Then anger, I never experienced that. Anger, or anger at myself, or anger at her. Now, again, they say a lot of times that you get angry at the dead person. One of the differences between men and women is that a lot of times that they get angry. A man will take the death more philosophical than a woman, with more reality to begin with. He doesn't break down in his emotions as much as a woman does to start with. But about a month later is when it says that it hits a lot of men, and when they get angry at their wife for leaving them. And they get angry, why did she leave me at this time? And they actually get angry at the wife. And especially, I think, that if you have young children, well, there's a great burden where you really need, you know, that wife right at that time. Why, it's awfully easy to get angry at the person who has died. Then in the next one down here, in despair, it's agony, grief, anguish, and depression. This might be a good chart to show, really, that this up here is kind of what's going on the first few days. Then you get down in here in despair, and that is when the real grief, that real painful grief, then actually hits you. And last week I made the observation, and all books make the observation, that we think that a grieving person is hurting at this time. that this is when they're hurting and that's when they need help. They do need help. But right here is where the real pain and just that intense, real terrible pain actually hits. And the agony, grief, anguish, and depression, and yeah, I can relate to all of them. By depression, maybe I ought to say something about that. The depression you have when you lose a loved one is not the same depression that a person has when they have to go get mental health, under normal circumstances. They have cataloged lots of differences between the two, just many differences between the two. Now, one difference that you could see, I think, and you can observe this, is that when you're around a depressed person, what is really called a depressed person, you leave feeling depressed. That's the way you feel. When you're around a grieving person who is in depression, you do not leave feeling depressed, you leave feeling hurt. There's really a difference. You go away and you can, and I think that you've done this with me. Probably you've gone away and you've been hurt when you were around me and felt deep pain, and when you got away, why you didn't just go home and sit down and you were depressed all day. You say, well, Lowell will come out of it. You know, he's got so much that he has to go through. He's going to make it. It hurt while we were talking with him, but he's going to make it. And you can have that attitude. With a real depressed person, you don't have that attitude. You feel depressed yourself. There's lots of differences between them. But by depression, what they mean is that you just do not have any self-esteem. You do not have any real reason that you want to live. And you're going to have that. You're going to lose your self-esteem to a certain extent. I think that I almost totally lost my self-esteem. I really, really think that. And as far as wanting to live, I totally lost it. There wasn't a thing that I wanted to do more than to die. It was just, I was on the bottom rung when it came to those. And the grief and the agony and the pain is, it's just undescribable, really. But the encouragement that I can give is that you do get over it, it does change, and you do come out of it. If you'd told me that a few weeks ago, I'd have thought that you were crazy. This one over here in detachment, they've got apathy, indifference, loss of interest, a desire to withdraw and give up. You do have apathy. You do have this indifference. You lose interest in everything. You don't particularly care. I mean, if your house burns down, it's not a big deal. Whatever happens is not a big deal. It doesn't make any difference what happens. You do have a desire just to withdraw and give up. However, what I did was when I would feel that feeling coming on, just the very first, I would fight that. And I did not want that to get set and rooted in my life of withdrawing and giving up. And that's the reason that every night I'd set my alarm clock so I had to get up of a morning at a certain time and make myself get up. I would dress as though I was going out on a very important appointment. If I'm going home and I'm sitting in the living room, I'm going to generally have my tie on. I look like President Reagan on television. In other words, trying to give yourself something of self-esteem in every way that you possibly can. And so when you see me start running around again with my blue jeans on and stuff, well, you'll know that's a good sign I'm feeling better and don't need to try to fool myself that I'm doing something important or something of that nature. And those are things that you get. And they said, once you go through that, then you can head out here on the road to recovery. That really is where I think I am now. I think that I'm headed out here. These feelings are still there, as you could see. As I was talking tonight, I did shed some tears. I didn't think I would when I came out here. But I did. The pain's there. There's a hurt there. But it's certainly a different kind of hurt than I've been having. It's a totally different kind of hurt. Here's another list of some things that they talk about real quickly. Agitation, crying, aimless activity, preoccupation with the image of the deceased, tears, muscular weakness, social withdrawal, decreased concentration, restlessness and anxiety and depressed moods and illusions and hallucinations and trying to pick up some things that I haven't read to you before here. The endocrine system changes, that your immune system changes. So really, all that I'm getting at is, and all that we need to know is that there are changes that take place, and it happens to almost everybody. Now here's an interesting thing, and they will have this down in future much more than they do now. They're trying to determine how much stress can you really take before you start having some problems. So, they've given certain numerical values to certain things. And they say, okay, now if you've had these particular things, then here it is. The death of a spouse, they say, they give the numerical value of 100. A change in your financial state, 38. A mortgage over 10,000, 31. Change in living conditions, 25. Revision of personal habits, 24. Change in residence, 20. A change in social activities, 18. A change in sleeping habits, 16. A change in eating habits, 15. Christmas time, 12. Now, what they're saying is really that everybody, at Christmas time, you're under more stress than what you are at other times. You know, even though you say, oh, Christmas is a nice period of time, there's more depression during Christmas than any other time of the season. See, psychiatrists are busier then than any other time. Now, what they say is that you can give certain stress values to this, and on this 299-point ratio right here, why, they advise you, if you have 200 or more units, to lie low for a while and suggest that it's good to talk with somebody or see a physician. I added mine up, and I'm in a safe zone of 196, so I don't have much to worry about there. I think it's interesting the way that they're doing those kind of things. Okay, now as we move into men and women, some of the other things here I want to talk about tonight. This one person here says, men have it better. More than 70% of men over 65 are married, compared to 30% of women. Now, these are facts, and men do have it better. Now, you stop to think about that, really. That tells a story right there, and especially to you women who will lose husbands. It's going to be harder on you throughout your life than it would be the other way. I can see that now. I wouldn't have believed that in a million years before Doris died. In fact, I still know that had I died before she did, she would have not gone through the outward grieving that you have seen me go through. You would have seen her much more composed than what you have seen me because of her nature, and I think being a woman also would help her to really be composed. But as I look at it and see the difference, that if I'd have left her and analyzed the situation, it just scares me to death. In her going before me, there's a period of time. The first year is going to be a tough year, but I can see that after that, that I'll be able to put my life together and I'll have a good life, and married or not married doesn't make any difference. I can have a good life. It would be real tough for her to have to be able to say that same thing, and it would take much longer than any year, and I can begin to see that in this situation. On widows, some of this is kind of disorganized and kind of taking it down here. Okay, it says, by the end of the first year of bereavement, most widows reported that their energy level had returned to about what they had been before their husband's death. Some widows whose grief had earlier caused them to appear drawn and stressed were being told that they were once again looking their old self. Some were dating and one was engaged to be married. Not all widows were doing well, however. 28% agreed at the end of the first year with the statement, I would not care if I died tomorrow. So they carried that attitude on down to the end of the year. Now, I'm over that. I could have said that very, very easily, and I could have even made it stronger than that, that I wished that I would die today and not have to wait till tomorrow, see? But 28% of the widows carried that all the way down for a year. A few reported that their grief had continued unabated and was as intense at the end of the year as it had been at the beginning. And still other widows, though they claimed partial recovery, seemed compelled to dissipate their feelings and so forth and get back to a normal life. It said it would appear that widows who moved toward remarriage began dating about a year after losing their husband. Most of these widows had reported by the end of the first year of bereavement that they had hoped to remarry. Now, I'm skipping some things in there, but I'm just getting to the heart of the matter. That is that it appears that people who lose their mates fall into two categories, and they do so pretty quickly, I think. And that is that you either fall into the category of I want to remarry or I don't want to remarry. And you begin looking out there and putting things together, and those who fall into the category I don't want to remarry generally do not ever remarry. Those who say I do want to remarry, and they do want to, generally within a year are taking active steps toward that in some way or another, is really what that is saying. Now, what I want to do now is read just isolated excerpts here from a study contrasting widowers with widows to see the difference that we have. All right, now, so bereavement for our sample of widowers, was in some way a similar experience and in some ways quite different. In other words, a lot of ways that they're the same, a lot of ways that there are tremendous amounts of difference. Now, the impact of the loss, when you lose the loved one, the initial impact, how is it accepted? All right, he said, we can summarize our data regarding the reactions of men to the loss of their wives by saying that insofar as men reacted simply to the loss of a loved other, just that, I've lost my loved one, their responses were similar to those of widows. But insofar as men reacted to the traumatic disruption of their lives, the responses of men were different. Now, I think this is important, so I want to say that again. If you break it down and you ask a man or a woman and about how do you feel about losing your loved one, there's no difference. There's no way that they can find that there's any difference. But then if you ask, how do you feel about the disruption of your life, then there is a vast difference between them. Now, this is where it hurts a man much more than it hurts a woman. A woman is more capable of carrying on the life that she is used to in taking care of the kids or taking care of the house and cooking and washing dishes and washing clothes and doing those thousands of things that we don't realize that a man does not do. You know, I mean, I walk by the washing machine, so I know what a washing machine is, and I'm sure that I could use a washing machine. But then all of a sudden, in my life, there comes a disruption, and everything is disrupted. I mean, there is nothing. There's not one thing, you see, that is not disrupted, except, I guess, when I'm here in the office and preaching. That would be about the only thing. But any other thing that has to do with my life is disrupted. Somebody comes to the house when I'm there. I'm at a loss. I take their coat and go hang it up in the closet and ask if they want a glass of water. There's a glass in there and there's a sink there. And that's about all you see that I would know how to do. So it's a tremendous difference. And so widows are able to settle back down, and during that first year, you see as we had up here, during that first year, the change of their lifestyle is not nearly as traumatic as it is with a man. He goes on and says, although painful grief seemed as regular an occurrence among men as among women, men tended to interpret their loss somewhat differently. More often than women, men tended to define what had happened to them as a dismemberment rather than an abandonment. Now, the talk goes on like this, that a man generally says, when my wife died, I lost part of myself. Another one says, I feel like part of my body was cut down. Another one says, I feel like both of my arms were cut off. But widows generally, in contrast, say that they feel like they've been deserted, abandoned, left to fend for themselves. Now, there, of course, is a difference in that. And that is that a woman depends on the man to care for her, to provide for her, her financial stability and her way of life, even in a social realm. A man, when he leaves, she's left then, she's just abandoned to, what will I do? I do not have the means to go ahead to do these things. A man, though, generally is surrounded by a wife or taken care of by a wife who does almost everything for him, whether he knows it or not. You know, I mean, washes his shirt and hangs them up and he puts them on and she says that's a wrong shirt and he takes it off. And you get to thinking about everything that a woman does to a man, and just really his whole life is surrounded to her somehow. So this is certainly the way I felt. I never had any feeling that I'd been abandoned, that she abandoned me at all. But I did have a feeling that I had been dismembered, that I had been cut in two. That I'd just been cut in two, half of me left there, and say, okay, now go ahead and take care of your life, see? And there is a difference there. All right. Men, much more than women, were unable or unwilling to display their grief. A third of the men reported that they were unable to cry, but choked up instead, something reported by only one woman in eight. As the year of bereavement progressed, men, more quickly than women, ended emotional display. By the end of the year, only 40% of men said they continued sometimes to cry, compared with 74% of the women. So there's quite a lot on that, that men have been taught that crying is not manly, that you ought to hold back your crying. Do not do that. And so many of them talked about how that they tried to do it, and they'd break down at the funeral, and then they would go home, and they would feel guilty and feel like a sissy or a baby because they did it that way. And then they have a guilty conscience along those lines. And, fellows, one thing I would say to you is to read your Bible and understand that real men know how to use their emotions. Real men use everything that God gave them. Now, real men do not go around crying about everything, and they're not a bunch of crybabies. But when something happens as grievous as this, when you lose something that is more dear to you than your very life yourself, and you try to hold in and not cry, the only person that you're hurting is yourself. And you remember that the great men of the Bible used tears in their suffering. And so I'd want to urge you not to be ashamed of it at all. All right, the next thing is talking about a commitment to realism. That men look at things in what is generally called the real world with more realism than a woman does. It said, about the same proportion of widows as widowers had forewarnings of the spouse's deaths. But 42% of the men had given up hope before the spouse's actual death, compared with only 15% of the women. Now you think about that, which tells you again the difference between a man and a woman. Now what we're talking about is that here's a man takes his wife into the hospital 6 months ago, and a woman takes her husband in. They're both diagnosed with an incurable disease, and the doctor says they'll never leave the hospital, they're going to die in a few months. Well, they get worse and worse and worse and worse. Now, 42% of the men had accepted the fact that she is going to die. And when she died, her death was not nearly as traumatic as it would have been the other way, see, because they had already gone through a certain part of that grieving, and so they were able to handle it and recover much more rapidly. But only 15% of the women were able to realize it and say, okay, I accept the fact that my husband is going to die. This is just an illustration of the difference between them. Another one, only one of 22 men with whom we had early interviews reacted to his wife's death by saying something like, it's not fair. Whereas almost one woman in four said something like this. Now, one man in 22 says it's not fair. Now, I've never really felt that. You see, I mean, I can relate to that. I've never said it's not fair, even though she was young. All that, I don't feel that. It's not fair. But 25% of the women feel it's not fair when their husband dies. Then men were not as successful in managing guilt as they were in managing anger. Now, again, women seem to become angry more than men do. A woman will become angry at herself or at her husband, and a lot of times, of course, she's justified being angry at the husband, I suppose, for some of the things he doesn't do. For instance, if he's drinking and he gets killed, she's angry at him because he murdered himself. And there's some justification in that. If she's been trying to get him to go to the doctor, he's had some chest pains. And of course, the common practice among men, no, I'm all right, you know, I'm eternal, I'll never die, and so we don't go to the doctor. And so a man drops dead with a heart attack. She gets very angry at him, gets mad at him. And so I think that there's some justification in it. But they were not successful in managing the guilt. All right, it says, in a large sampling here of women, they blame themselves for having in some way contributed to their spouse's death. They felt guilty for failing their spouses in some way. Men blame themselves for such failures as not having been sufficiently sensitive to their illness, not having required their spouse to see a physician, not having prevented the accident that led to the death. Two men who had lost their wives in childbirth blamed themselves because they were the ones that got her pregnant. The greater prominence of guilt among men is true only for a period immediately after the death of the spouse. Now listen to this. This is interesting. The man feels guilty immediately after the death of the spouse. Within the first 2 months after the bereavement, most men who had felt guilty no longer did. But women who did not feel guilty during the first 2 months started feeling guilty after 2 months was up. That's when they started their guilt feelings. Now, between the first and second months after the death, whereas the proportion of widows having such thoughts increased from 28% to 40%, a widow's guilt increases. 28% of them has guilt feelings immediately after he dies. 2 months later, 40% of them have it. Now, during the same period, a widower, exhibits less guilt as time goes on. Men seem to seek for more control in their life, to control their life. And so, as they do this, they do not try to they try to control all of the occasions around them, and they do not try to recall all of the vivid memories of the death, of going over it and over it and over it and over it. Both men and women have to wrestle with that, and you have to go through that. But women do it more than men. Finally, men are able to say, it wouldn't do any good anyway. If I could recall every detail, it wouldn't do any good. A woman takes much, much longer in doing that. She goes on up to try to remember those things, whereas a man does away with them. Now, this has happened to me. For a period of time, for the first 8 weeks, I had a burning desire. I had every intention in the world going over and talking to the doctor and asking him detailed questions about just exactly what happened, what broke loose, where did it break loose, where did it lodge, what would have happened if he hadn't have done this, what would have happened if she lived. And I had 1,000 questions I wanted to know, but I had sense enough to know that I was in an emotional state and I'd be wasting his time, and I was going to wait until I knew I could think logically so that I could ask him only the questions that were needed. And when I finally got to that, well, then I realized there's no need of asking questions. If I knew everything about it, it would not bring her back. There would be no change whatsoever. And so I've been able to put that out of my mind now, and that doesn't bother me. A woman has a tremendous time of doing that.
it states down here that men's greater commitment to realism displayed itself in a greater willingness to believe that the spouse might actually return. Over half of the widows reported such feelings, compared with fewer than one-fifth of the men. Now again, you have an urge, you have a desire, but like I told you, I never had any anticipation, never had any expectation. You see, only one out of every five men do have any anticipation, but a goodly percent of the women really display a willingness to believe somehow he might come back. And of course, this is just the way that the minds work. Men seem not to engage in intense and prolonged reviews of the circumstance. I've talked about that. They shake it off more quickly. Widowers, in contrast to widows, appear to find little value in again rehearsing the events that had led to their spouse's death. They would do so when pressed by our interviewers, but even then they did not display the recall of some details that widows did. More than widows, they appeared uncomfortable when asked to return to the past. In other words, when a year was up, when they interviewed a man, he didn't particularly want to talk about, here's what happened, here's how she died. The widows did. All right, managing in the first few weeks. Widows were seen as needing relief from their daily duties so they could attend to their feelings. They were understood as overwhelmed, prostrated with grief, as needing sympathetic attention, emotional support. Widowers were seen as needing some help with their new responsibilities for the home and for children. Different people move in and help. And it gives percentages of friends and relatives and so forth. And this is an interesting thing that I think. Widows were helped often by their mother-in-laws. 25% reported this. Now, my mother-in-law is wanting to come back and visit up here, and she is planning on coming back on Doris's birthday, last week of March. She's wanting to come back to help herself and, of course, to help us and put it all together, so it's here. Their sister-in-law's health is reported by 30%. The helpful brother-in-law was almost solely absent in the case of widows. With men, the brother-in-law had no role. Now, that's kind of an interesting thing. In the brother-in-law situation, the only role that they play is with, really, a widow. Now, this is interesting. It's happened with me. I haven't even heard one word from one of my brother-in-laws, three others. How many brother-in-laws do I have? Well, nothing is really it. I was over at one brother-in-law's house when there was a bunch of people came in, and so we talked a little bit, and he obviously said something to me. I don't remember what we talked about, but no help whatsoever, and I didn't expect any help, and I didn't even realize it until I heard that, and I don't guess I would have helped him. It's a normal thing. 36% of the widows reported that their brother-in-laws to have been very helpful to them, and said only one man out of all that they interviewed said that he was helped in any way by a brother-in-law. Widowers were more likely than widows to try to make their own way without asking for help. Gives reporting on that. In general, although the widows were more concerned than the widowed with how they would manage household tasks and child care, they were more confident with their ability ultimately to recover from their loss. Only 20% said that they ever feared that they would have a nervous breakdown and so forth. 52% of the widows said they thought they would have a nervous breakdown. I've never dreamed of having a nervous breakdown and never thought that I couldn't handle the situation. I've always felt that I would come out of it. I didn't see how it could be possible, but always thought that I would. Men, much less than widows, were upset by the funeral and burial rituals, such as seeing the corpse and by attending a funeral or a burial. They did not seem to have to mobilize themselves and so forth, and this is kind of interesting, but it's not shocking. In general, they did not seem to give these ceremonies the emotional importance given them by the widows. they wanted to express through the ceremonies their love and respect for their wives, but they were more concerned with how they would manage the subsequent months than with the management of the ceremonies. Widows tended to see each ceremony almost a milestone, but widowers wanted to get through with the ceremony so that they could get on with the reestablishment of their life. Now, this is the way I felt in this, that I wanted, just urgently hoping and wanting to get those things over so we could get on with life and putting it together and whatever had to be done. But a woman does not feel that way. Now, it goes ahead and it says, associated with their lesser investment in ceremonials, widowers gave much less attention to details such as the kind and quality of flowers at the funeral, the length of service, and who attended, and all of the social amenities women are very interested in. Men aren't. To be truthful with you, I could have cared less. I mean, just to be truthful with you. When they came in, what kind of flowers do you want to get from all? I don't care. You order them. I don't know who ordered them. Kim, did you order them, or Carol, or I don't know. You did. I did not know. When we went to the funeral, they showed me this is what the flower is, and I do not have the slightest idea right now what it looked like. If you showed me a picture, I would not know. I didn't care. I appreciated the flowers so much that you cannot begin to comprehend how much I appreciated flowers that everybody sent. Who sent the flowers that was up there at the funeral? In other words, when you go to the funeral and you look at them and say, oh, who sent this? Oh, so-and-so sent this, and so forth, really had no meaning to me. Later, I went through the cards. They kept all the cards and all of that, and I wanted to write letters, and I did, and I'm sure that I missed a lot, but I tried the best I could. But as far as the flowers I got and such things as that, that really was meaningless. But I can't tell you how much the flowers meant. Things of this nature, we learned so much. When Doris's dad died, I was shocked when she came back and she was telling about, you know, what they did with the flowers. And that is that she and her mom went through all the flowers, and they looked at every flower, and they looked at every name and who sent the flowers, and they went over them, and they went over them, and they went over them, and they went over them again. To a woman, it means a tremendously great thing. One thing that might hurt a little bit, but it will help all of us to understand how much these things really mean, is that when she got back, she was deeply hurt about the brethren here at Kirkland. And the only time that she ever wanted to leave in her 25-year history was then, that she urged me to move 3 years ago. And there was not a flower sent from anybody up here. And it hurt her so tremendously. She said, if that's all that I'm loved, I want to move and start a new life somewhere else. And I had to sit down with her and talk with her. It was quite a traumatic experience. It went on for several days. Quite a traumatic experience. And sat down and said, honey, you do exactly the same thing. It's not that people do not love you. It's just that we do not know what to do. We do not think is what the situation is. We just do not think. I said, now stop to think. Did you send flowers to so-and-so? Have you sent flowers? Do you send flowers out like this? Well, no, but it's different, and so forth. And in talking with her, why she did then understand. And there were three women who did bring flowers out to the house then about a week later. She nurtured those flowers. She coveted those flowers. She watered those flowers. She kept those flowers. And I suppose that those flowers are still in my house. I don't know. But just to show you how much the flowers really means. Now, I'm not saying that to hurt anybody, because I am one of you. And there have been other people who have died and people who have gone back to funerals and so forth, and flowers were not sent. And I did not send flowers. And so I'm as guilty as anybody else. I'm merely stating it because I think that it might teach us all a good lesson of how important just small little things are in hours of grief, and how a thing that is not important to a man at all is important to a woman. And so I would not have thought one thing about it, if when my sister died, now there was a big bouquet of flowers sent from Kirkland, many of you sent them. I would not have thought one thing about it if it hadn't. But it meant a lot to her, and when I got back, she was asking, wanted to know what the flowers looked like and what it was and when they got there, and just meant a great deal to her. And so the difference between a man and a woman in that respect is just absolutely so unbelievable that you just have to hear something like this to really comprehend it. And so the difference between, it says, the man and the woman in that respect is like light and darkness. Grief, mourning, and recovering. Widowers seem to be distinctly less likely than widows to be worried about how they will manage their financial situation. I'm going to talk about that later. That obviously is true. In some, it appears that widowers did not move toward emotional recovery more quickly than did widows. Now, well, it goes ahead. It says, however, they did move more quickly toward reestablishing a stable life organization based on remarriage, thus toward a social recovery. Now, they study this in the respect of an emotional recovery and social recovery. Emotional recovery, obviously, is how you are emotionally attached to the loved one. There seems to be no difference between a man and a woman in that respect, that it takes so long period of time. Everybody says it is impossible for it to be done in less than a year just because of the dates involved, that you cannot go through the date of the death in less than a year. And all the warnings are to get prepared for such days as birthdays and anniversaries and the date of a death. And the first date of the death is a very traumatic thing. And I can imagine it will be just talking about it hurts. And I don't know why. Silly. I haven't been there. Why? But just thinking about it, see? Now, the social recovery, and that is of getting out and putting your social life back together and finally remarrying, widowers do that much more quickly. There are a number of reasons, I think, involved in that. They trying to break it down, they really don't know why, and trying to get through it. But again, I think that it's very obvious that a man has more opportunity to get out into the social realm. A man in our society is the aggressor. He is the pursuer. Men find that being alone affects their work, and they try to reestablish a family so they can become as effective in their work as they were before. There are just several things, and that's one thing why the sociologists think that maybe men marry quicker than women, so much quicker, is because that they're just crying out, I need to reestablish my life so I can get on with my work, of which I take a great deal of pride in. So they put a lot of connection together in that. Women and men seem to define somewhat differently the nature of their continuing obligation to their deceased spouse. Widows tended to feel that loyalty to their deceased spouse much longer than a widower did. What we're getting at is doing what the spouse would want done. I've lived all my life in activities of, are we going out to dinner tonight? Well, does Doris want to? Are we going to buy a new car? Well, what kind would she like to buy? It's always, you know, what would be pleasing to the other person. And when they die, you continue that, and you all of a sudden have a desire to even do it more. I want to do more now, what she would like, because she's not here. And, of course, that's just an emotional reaction. It's not a logical thing. Now, a woman has a harder time cutting that than does a man. I guess the hardest thing that I've had to cut those crazy towels with the hoodals on them that I told you about. I've sat down and logically thought about this, and everything I do, I think, what would she like? And then I have to say, what difference does it make? I just have to talk to myself in that realm. It makes no difference what she would like, what I do today. She does not care what I do today. I have to do what I need to do and what I want to do, and it doesn't make any difference what she would like if she were here. And then you give yourself that lecture, and then you say, yeah, but what would she like? And it's a hard thing, really, to break. I'm in the process of trying to break myself of that right now. I've done a pretty good job of it in just like food. This sounds kind of silly. Some of you have never eaten with me, but those who have can testify. I never order a dinner for myself. See, I never. I'd sit down and I'd start talking and visiting, and when the waitress would come around, well, what do you want? I'd ask her, what do I want? And she would say, you want this, and so I'd order whatever she said. And I just generally ate the same things and ate what she thought, you know, that I ought to be eating, and those things really had no meaning for me. It just I'd rather have this other relationship as to pick through a menu and try to decide what I was going to eat and so forth. Well, it's been, I didn't even know what any other salad dressing tastes like other than French dressing until right after the death. I said, well, I'm going to try blue cheese, and I tried it. I like it. And I'm not ever going to try anything Maurice tries. He mixes them up. But I tried it, and I've ordered other things, and I purposely go into a restaurant. What do you want? Well, okay, I want to eat something I've never eaten before. And I order something that I've never eaten before. And I'm proud of myself, and I feel like I've just committed a little bit of adultery, not a whole lot. You feel unfaithful. You feel, what have I done? I mean, you just feel like this. What have I done? You just feel, you feel a little dirty, and then you have to talk to yourself, but this is what she would want. And I know it is. And one of the things I'll say, if I die in the next year or two, probably, you know, I'll say, guess what, honey? I ate a lot of things you didn't know anything about. And I think she'd be proud of me. So, but it's hard to do that. And I'm working on that right now. So when I order some crazy things, like, you guys know what I'm doing. Getting into the remarried situation, we talked about that. By the end of the first year of their bereavement, 50% of the widows, the widowers, had remarried or were associating with someone on a basis that could be considered premarital, as compared with 18% of the widows. This is some other situations. Okay. That concludes what I want to conclude on some of that other stuff, and brings us down to this. Now, are there any questions anybody has? No, I haven't. When they have their mates cremated, you can do two things. You can either have them buried, and of course, it's just a little slot there, or you can spread them out over the ocean, or take them home, or do whatever you want to do. And what I have read is that in funerals, and I won't be talking about this, so better talk about it now. It reminds me right there. That in funerals, where you the trend in America today is to go to less and less funerals, more memorial services and cremations. In other words, it's being pushed. You know that for a regular funeral service, it's going to cost you about $3,000. As cheap as you can possibly get by, that's what it's going to cost you. For a burial site, it's going to be between $600 and $1,000. So you're looking at over $3,000 any way you look at it. I don't care how you do it. For a regular funeral. For a cremation, it's about $300. And so there's a lot of difference in the cost.
Then in our society, people are wanting to get away from that which is sorrowful, and so trying to go to a lesser thing than a regular funeral. They really have what they call a memorial service. So what is being pushed in America today is to have the person cremated and then 2 or 3 days later get together and have a memorial service and the body is not present. Now, when that happens, there are a lot of psychological problems that they're fighting. Because there is a reason why we've been having funerals for so long. When you have a custom, and that custom has been around for a long, long period of time, you better stop and ask yourself why, because there's always a good reason why it's there. Now, really, the purpose of a funeral is to give the bereaved an opportunity to begin to say goodbye. It's where you're actually, you know, saying goodbye. Going to the gravesite looks tormenting. And remember, I even asked the kids, would you like to skip that part? Because I dreaded that so badly, taking her body out there and putting it over that hole in the ground. I didn't think I could stand it. And I'm so glad we did it. I can see now the value in it. It gives you a chance to literally say, I've gone the last step. I've gone as far as I can with you. If I hadn't done it, I'd always felt it. That I hadn't have done all that I could do. It's a very necessary thing. And they found that people who go through just a plain memorial service, there's no body, you don't see the body, everything is kept real neat, that those people have not gone through that saying, that goodbye, and they just have quite a lot more problems than other people. This is the reason why when somebody is missing in action, like in Vietnam, mothers and their widows and so forth over here are just not able to put their lives back together again for years and years and years and years. And they find the body, and it might not be any more than a skeleton with some dog tags on it, but the government brings it back, puts it in a casket, brings it there, and says, there is your son and your husband. And they go to a funeral, and they look at the casket. They can't look inside the casket, but it's verified the body is in there. Okay, he's in there. They take him out and bury him, and then begin to heal up. And lots of verification of this. And so it's just a stated fact and a scientific fact that you have to go through certain ceremonial procedures of saying goodbye. Now, I'm not saying it has to be a funeral. You know, in other countries, they do it in different ways. They come together and spend 5 or 6 days, you know, throwing a big party and eating and doing things and then go out and bury it. But there needs to be some acceptable, respectable way of where that body is there of saying goodbye to it. And so you want to think about that if you're thinking about cremation. Consider that one aspect, because that is something that the studies have shown. Okay, anything else?
Mold, in my father's eyes years ago, died of a terminal illness for over 3 years. And I found for myself, by the time his death occurred, most of my grieving was over.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you and Doris both knew about her diabetes,
mm-hmm.
how that could just suddenly come loose and cause the death of the deer.
Mm-hmm.
Did that, or has that in any way, that knowledge that you had prior to that, has that in any way at all affected the period of grief you've gone through?
When you say any way, it has. Now, in what you're asking, I think the answer is no. So I'm going to answer no, and then I'm going to change it in just a minute. No. Knowing that she had diabetes and knowing that diabetics die younger because of complications and so forth meant exactly the same to me as you knowing that a lot of people die in automobile accidents and your wife drives around and there's a good chance that she will get killed in an automobile accident. Now, when she does, if she gets killed in an automobile accident tomorrow, then I could ask you, will that lessen your grief any? Well, you say, well, I knew there was a good chance. All right, now that is exactly the feeling I had about her diabetes. See, that as you go through life, you do not say, okay, you know, you're going to die this year or next year. It is totally different than your death. See, her death was what you'd call a sudden death. It was just a shock to me. I had no idea. She had told me the week before, you know, when she said, honey, right now is the best time in our life for me to die. She had stated, she said, we both know, that I'll have a lot of problems in the next 10 years, and I can't live to be an old lady. Said, we know that. Which meant exactly the same to me as me telling a lot of you people are not going to live to be old ladies, you know, but is it your wife? See? No, Art, it had nothing. Now, let me change it, and yes, in some way it has. That I've been able to look at this and state now, since she did die, since the shock is there, to look at the good things. And I try to look at the good things in it. And you say, are there any good things that she died, you know, that you can look at that gives you comfort? Yes, there is. And that is that now I know and I realize that had she lived, that there would have been a lot of pain. The older she got, the more complications she would have. And had she lived and had I been able to keep her for another 10 to 20 years, it would have heaped a lot of pain upon her. And so it does give me comfort to know that she doesn't have to go through that suffering. See, that does give me comfort. So in that respect, it does. But in the other respect, I think the way you said it, doesn't. Now, if your dad or your mom or your mate is in the hospital and they're dying and they're going through a tremendous amount of pain, you're ready for them to die, aren't you, Art? It's a comfort when they do die. Now, you don't laugh about it. I mean, there's grief and there's sorrow, see? But there is a comfort that is there. You go through a lot of the grief in the 2 or 3 years before they die that I've gone through in the last 15 weeks all compassed in there. So that's the reason mine is so heavy and yours is spread out, you see. So you don't go through so much grief. It's just that. And how do you take it? So really, the people who study this say that it's better to have your mate in the hospital with a terminal illness and you go through down to death, and then they die, and then you go ahead. Really, you adjust better in that way than you do with the way Doris was taken. You readjust. More people get remarried, you know, after this other lingering than they do with a sudden death like mine. And the adjustment is quicker back to your social life and so forth. Now, I can honestly say, though, that if I had the opportunity to trade, I wouldn't trade. I really wouldn't. And I'm saying that in ignorance because I don't know what it's like to go through the other. You see, what you did. But I just can't see where... Boy, I just... to see somebody suffer for that period of time is something that... I'm glad it happened this way. Even though the books say it's harder this way. Yeah.
I want to comment about what you said about the school.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from the southern state of Mississippi. They got out there, I know they're called waiting, and, you know, they were losing bodies in the place overnight. People stay there and deal with it, you know, sit there and get the
right. Right. That's the person, a purpose for these wakes. Now, again, this is done away with. See, when I was a boy, this was always done. Bodies were brought to the home. They were stayed right to the home and stayed there for 3 days. All the families and all the friends came in, and people stayed with the body 24 hours a day. And there was a getting used to this, you see, so that you can say goodbye. Again, in our society, we don't do this. We've done away with that. Still, back in my hometown of Illinois, there is a night set aside, like all of you did here, you know, that Sunday night came down. There's a night set aside. It's just the normal practice, and everybody goes up and they visit the funeral home and they view the body and they talk to the family and so forth. But out here,
In our more progressive society, and let's face it, that's the reason we live in Washington, is because of trying to be pioneers and so forth, we don't have that. And funeral directors don't even know how to handle it. They just don't even know how to handle it, really. They're shocked when somebody wants it. Steve.
I was going to ask, do you have any thoughts on this new aspect of dying in community? A lot of people are saying you don't want to die in a hospital anymore because of all this stress.
Mm-hmm.
But about the person that's laying there being supported by the machine,
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that.
Yeah, I do. I had some experience with that with my sister. And then I've read some on that, and of course then my own personal feelings, if you say that, which doesn't make me an expert, but I do have some feelings on it. I think dying with dignity, I think that there's a lot to be said with it, for it. That the medical profession today really has one thing in mind, and that is just seeing how long they can keep you alive. They have no perspective about death whatsoever. You know, of whether you ought to die. When you die, it means they failed. See, and it's just a matter of facts and figures and medicine and so much of this and a needle here and there. And if you die, well, I lost that one. You know, it's kind of like the Mariners losing a baseball game. And the medical profession and many of them and the nurses are upset about this particular attitude you see that they have. To give you a specific answer of when to pull the plug, I can't do. But I would say this, that the studies show that 70% of the people in the society today die in a hospital. The vast majority of them who die in a hospital do not have a family around them when they die. And one of the reasons they do not have a family around them when they die is because as the patient gets worse and worse and the doctor begins to see that the patient will probably not live through the night, they send the family home. That's when they're going to come to Pam and say, Pam, you need some rest. You know, Steve is doing, he's doing great. Steve, you know, it's fine. And we're taking care of him. And you get on home, Pam. She goes home and gets a telephone call, you see, in the morning that you died during the night. And this happens over and over and over and over again. The studies show that doctors really, really react this way. And they try to usher out. And in other words, our society is geared to get rid of this thing, you see. It's a death-denying society. Now, the studies again show that the people who die at home, they are able to adjust. They're happier being able to be in that normal familiar circumstances, and the people that are there with you when you die are really feel a comfort to be with you because they know they've gone the last mile with you, and it gives us a tremendous comfort. And you'd be surprised that when this happens, how little things really count. You know, how little things really count, because guilt is a tremendous thing. And many times that a wife is not there when the husband dies, and then she feels guilty because she went home and left you there suffering, and you died, and you're probably in pain, and you know, and she didn't love you the way she loves you, and on she goes. So add a few more months of grief to her, like that. And I'm for that. Now, when you get down to do you pull the plug and do you do things like this, medical science has it now to where they do not know how to define death. This is the big problem. So as you read death, what is death? It takes page after page after page after page. They say there's brain death, there's organ death, there's breath death, there's heart death, there's all different kinds of death, you see, that they measure it by. And now the reason why that they can't measure it today is, let's take my sister. She had a cerebral hemorrhage that burst in her head, massive, just soaked her whole brain in blood, is the way that they put it, and wherever blood touches, it kills the brain. That's the way they described it to me. And they had her in there on a respirator, breathing for her, see, and had something pumping her heart, and every one of the vital things that you need, they had a machine on her, and they said, we can keep her alive indefinitely. And the doctor said, now, she is not alive. And here, you take the CAT scan, you take anything, and the brain wave is just flat. It just, there's no electrical impulse in there, but she's breathing, and all this. I said, what happens if you pull that, if you pull that, you turn that machine off? They said, never take another breath. Not another heartbeat. I mean, the only thing that's causing that heart to beat is that electrical impulse that you're putting out. The only thing that's causing that breath is that respirator that's pumping that oxygen. Yeah, that's it. And in every way you can measure, you know, she's dead. However, we can keep her alive however you want. Take her temperature, it's 98.6. If it goes in high, we'll bring it down. If it goes in low, we'll bring it up. And so they've got it like that now. So you then have to ask yourself, okay, is she alive? Is she not alive? What is the situation? And I believe that you ought to take all the efforts that you can to keep a person alive as long as you can, as long as life has a meaning. In other words, as long as life can be considered life. See, but just to keep a body warm, I don't believe it. And so the doctor said, we think we should pull the plug. And the husband said, we think, you know, he thinks you should pull the plug. And I said, I don't, that's what I would do is pull it and see what happens. And they pulled the plug, and just like that, you know, she was gone. I think she was dead. See? And now we had a decision. She'd still been alive years and years. I mean, maybe 30 years. Who knows? I mean, on that respirator. These are problems that we're going to have to face in this generation, in fact, that we are facing in this generation. And I'm not for euthanasia in any form of the word, see, not for taking a life in any way, but I certainly don't want you to go to all kind of extremes to keep my life when my life is ready to be gone, is my feeling really on it. Is there another question?
Mm-hmm. Would you say that the group that we have after we lost the knowledge would think a lot of different from what I would? Oh, I wouldn't be able to answer that. I don't know. The question is, would the grief, if you've lost a non-Christian, be a lot harder? It obviously would be harder, Kathy, I think. But, I mean, personal experience, you know, I can't say. I can only tell you how much comfort that I've received in the fact that she is a Christian. That I can't tell you how many hours I spent in just meditating and thinking about where she is and what she's doing and the joy. And I can just get elated, as I've said, all the way through. You know, back in my heavy grieving, I could just get on a high, if you want to put it that way, just elated, thinking about the joy that she's having. And today I went off just meditating, and I was thinking about that very thing. You know, just how wonderful that it really is, you see. And I was thinking about people that didn't have that, just the same question you asked. It just be a terribly lonesome feeling. Now, the grief, I think the way I'd answer your question, the best I would answer it with what limited knowledge I have, I think the grief would be the same. Because in reality, you're grieving for yourself. Let's face it. Now, the first part of this, you think you're grieving for the loved one. See, if you'd have asked me, I would have argued with you all night. I'm grieving for Doris. See? And I'll never forget when I drove up here at the office the first time, they were bulldozing this old Texaco station down over here. And I wanted to tell her so badly they're bulldozing that Texaco station. I wanted her to see that so badly, you know. And I was just so hurt that she was dead that she didn't get to see that. And I had to say, what would she care? You know, if I could call her up and tell her, hey, they're bulldozing the Texaco station, see. But what I was doing was I was wanting to share, as we've always done, see. I was wanting to be able to tell her these things. And now then I can see you grieve for yourself, is what you do. So I would say the grief would be exactly the same, but the comfort that a Christian receives is so utterly greater that I wouldn't even know how to compare it. I wouldn't. And I think the Bible teaches that. That's the reason Paul says, You know, in 1 Thessalonians 4, where he tells about where a Christian is, and he says, "Now wherefore comfort one another with these words," see? And he said, "so that you sorrow not as the rest." I think that tells the whole story. Now that says that a Christian does sorrow. So you're going to have grief. But it's not the same way as the non-Christian. Yeah. So I think the grief is the same, but the elation and comfort, is just there's no comparison.
Is there any other? Okay.
If not, let us dismiss then tonight. And Robert, would you lead us in our prayer, please?